just sit there facing the hill. Just say, who gonna take away his license to kill? Now he's helping for destruction. He's afraid and confused, and his brain has been mismanaged with great
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Anita Isaacs, a professor of social sciences and political science at Haverford College. She's the author of Politics of Military Rule and Transition in Ecuador, At War with the Past, and the forthcoming book, The Politics of Transitional Justice in Postwar Guatemala. Her latest article at the New York Times is We Enable Genocide, But the Elite Committed It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anita Isaacs.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And today the Guatemalan top court annulled the genocide conviction of the General Rios Montt, and it looks like they're going to sort of, apparently the ruling does not annul the entire trial, but everything that happened after April the 19th, which of course are the closing arguments and the conviction, that all has to be retried. Is this some kind of ruse on the part of conservatives on the court to delay and perhaps deny justice?
Yes, it most definitely is, but it's not. They are not acting independently. They are acting under tremendous pressure from conservative sectors within Guatemalan society who refuse to acknowledge the verdict.
So this just gets back to this malignant oligarchy that runs the country. People that you have written about, in fact, Anita Isaacs, in your recent article in the New York Times, you mentioned that a member of the oligarchy wants to ask you in relation to this issue over genocide of the Mayans, quoting the oligarch, why do you ask why Indians were killed? A better question is, why didn't we kill more Indians?
Yes.
That's a mindset amongst the elite?
Yes, it is. That was an extreme statement, but it's not a statement that was confined to just one member of the oligarchy. It's a statement that in various iterations I've heard repeatedly over the years. So it's a quote from one, but it's representative of the views of a sector of Guatemalan society that retains considerable, that used to have a monopoly on power, and that retains considerable power today. But its grip on power is gradually slipping. And so their reaction to the trial and the verdict, you know, is an expression of their fear and their shame and their guilt about what it means to convict the general of crimes of genocide.
Well, apparently the oligarchy is also in bed with the drug lords. Isn't Guatemala considered a narco state? I've talked to a number of officials in various neighboring countries, and they have, off the record, told me that it's a narco state.
Yes, sectors of the oligarchy are in alliance with the narcos. I'm not sure that that's the sector that's been acting now. Mm-hmm. This, what we're seeing now, is more of a reaction of the formal and most traditional sectors of the oligarchy, sectors who were deeply involved in the brutality and the genocide of the 1980s, sectors of society who enlisted the military to carry out the brutal repression, sectors of the oligarchy who have been profoundly racist from the beginning and who allowed a brutal repression to transform itself into genocide, sectors of the oligarchy who care in their own way about Guatemala's international prestige, and sectors of the oligarchy who have always controlled the levers of political power. So the organized crime, yes, there are sectors of the elite that are in close contact, that collaborate with organized criminal networks. But I'm not sure that's the most distinguishing feature of those, or the motivating feature of those who are so resistant to and determined to overturn the verdict.
Again, I'm speaking with Anita Isaacs, a professor of social sciences and political science at Haverford College and the author of the forthcoming book, The Politics of Transitional Justice in Postwar Guatemala. Her latest article at the New York Times is We Enabled Genocide, But the Elite Committed It. And I guess from my understanding, from what you've written in the New York Times, Anita Isaacs, is that this oligarchical elite is paranoid and always has been because of the majority of the population of Guatemala are Mayan Indians. And that is that sort of drives this extraordinary compulsion to want to murder the majority of your own population.
Yes, you're right. If we cycle forward, though, to today and what motivates them and why they're so opposed to it, I think that, you know, I'd say that there are three or four reasons that occur to me immediately. One is the fear, well, one is something that they openly express, which is the concern that the image of Guatemala is going to be tarnished if Guatemala is recognized as a state, as a place where genocide was committed, that Guatemala is going to join the ranks, they tell me, of countries like Nazi Germany, or regimes like Nazi Germany, or the Rwanda, or Bosnia, or Cambodia. And they, for some reason in their mind, do not see themselves as in that same league. So there's a kind of embarrassment about passing their country on and having overseen a moment in their country's history where the state has been declared genocidal. So it's something that just they cannot tolerate.
Let me just get my head around this, Anita. You're saying that the Guatemalan elite, the oligarchs, they're not apologetic about the murder of 200,000 Mayan Indians. They're only concerned of the image of the country?
That's right. I mean, there's some other things that they're concerned about, but they're not apologetic. They don't acknowledge it. They're continued feelings of racism that are expressed through those feelings, of course. But yes, you've got it right. What they're worried about is not what happened. It's not shame about what happened. It's shame about how the country is going to be viewed by the international community and by their children, the kind of world or country that their children are going to inherit. That's part of it. I mean, they're also afraid. They're afraid because they're afraid of the implications. What does it mean to recognize what happened to Guatemalans, indigenous Mayan peoples? What does it mean that a court actually finds in their favor? It means that these people have rights, that these people are full citizens. And if these people are full citizens, well, you know, there's a fear because they're not like us. They're primitive on the one hand, so they shouldn't be full citizens. And on the other hand, they're also frightened because what does this mean in terms of the revenge that these people might seek, the lands that these people might claim, and the kind of impact that might have on our interests? So that's the second and third dimensions. And all of this is wrapped up in a situation where the elite is actually, these traditional elite that has historically controlled power in Guatemala, is gradually losing its grip. Power is slowly falling out of their hands. And the majority of society and is becoming more powerful. The playing field, the political playing field is becoming more level. And that is tremendously frightening to them.
And Anita Isaacs, your recent article in the New York Times, We Enabled Genocide, But the Elite Committed It, what I'm hearing from you and what I get from the article here is that we, in effect, enabled the elite as well. If you go back, as you do in your article, to the 1950s, to 1953, when the CIA conducted a coup against the Social Democratic President Jacobo Arbenz, quote, the U.S. ambassador there at the time as saying, and he was toppled because he was alleged to be a communist and was going to receive a shipment of arms from Czechoslovakia that may well have been a sting. The U.S. ambassador at the time in Guatemala, John Purifoy, he said famously, "I am definitely convinced if the president is not a communist, he will certainly do until someone comes along.
And yeah.
He will certainly do until one comes along.
That's
so
right.
There you have the cynicism that they put. They got rid of this social democrat, probably more to do with the United Fruits Company's land than the idea that the Soviets were meddling in our back door. But didn't that basically entrench the oligarchs and military rule?
Absolutely. There are a couple of things that were consequences of that. But yes, I mean, the oligarchy was also extremely worried, or as worried as the United States, and there were family connections between the State Department and the United Fruit Company, which also helped with the Alan Foster Dulles and John Foster Dulles were in both the State Department and the United Fruit Company. And so there were family connections that precipitated some of the U.S. involvement. But the oligarchy, the traditional landed elite, was as concerned for the same reasons as United Fruit Company was concerned about the possible nationalization or expropriation of lands as a result of land reform that was being contemplated and then was enacted. So, yes, the U.S. and the oligarchy saw eye to eye, if you want to put it in a, if you want to see it that way, in the 1950s. And the oligarchy collaborated actively with the United States and with the coup. They lent landing strips on their landed estates for planes to land. I have oligarchs who've told me in great detail about the whole operation. They even flew some planes. So they were actively involved in the coup. They were, the alliance that took power after the coup, the very reactionary alliance that basically turned back the clock and precipitated the rise of an insurgent revolutionary movement, was an alliance that had three legs to the stool. One of them was the United States, the other one was the oligarchy, and the third was the military. You know, I think that, you know, the Arbenz story is a very sad one, and it's sort of had enormous consequences for the continent in the course of history, because it was the failure, it was the toppling of Arbenz that, in fact, in many ways provoked the Cuban Revolution. Che Guevara was in Guatemala at the time of the Arbenz coup, and later went to Cuba and understood that you couldn't bring about reform peacefully, but that if you wanted to make reform in what the U.S. viewed as its backyard, you needed to stage a violent and armed uprising.
And, of course, in a curious way, I guess, that is echoed in what happened in Iran with the toppling of another social democrat.
At much the same time.
Right. So Anita Isaacs, again, professor of social sciences and political science at Haverford College and the author of the forthcoming book, The Politics of Transitional Justice in Postwar Guatemala. She also has an article at the New York Times recently, We Enable Genocide, But the Elite Committed It. Back to the overturning of the trial or the annulment of the verdict, and then they have to retry it after repeating everything that happened after April the 19th, the closing arguments, and then the conviction. What are the chances then of this reaching the same verdict?
That's a really good question. It's also a really good question. You know, there are a lot of legal questions. It's important to understand that this wasn't a legal decision. This was a political decision. So the legality and the legal ins and outs are very opaque and hard to understand, even for lawyers who've been watching this trial. So a lot of it is too complicated to figure out what the implications are for now, both by observers and even for those who are participants in it. How does a different tribunal start rehearing a trial in the middle? What is there? Which judge? It will depend on which judge is appointed, or which three-judge panel is appointed to hear the trial. It seems to be impossible for the same judge to just go back and rehear from April 19th. The date seems somewhat random to me. Actually, why April 19th? It's not at all clear. I was actually in Guatemala at the trial during those days, and there were a series of events, but it's not entirely clear why the trial needs to be restarted then. So the legal implications of it are, because this was not a decision that was really founded in law and jurisprudence, but was a result of political pressure, make it impossible to really understand or forecast what's going to happen. I think the next few days, next 4 days or so, this week, will probably tell us, you know, the direction that things are going to take. But I think that the chance of getting the trial back on track, and revisiting the closing arguments and having any chance of reaching a similar verdict, which for me is very much grounded in law. I think that the prosecution made a very strong case. Will in part depend on international pressure.
Well, let's touch on that just in closing then, Anita Isaacs. If the Guatemalan elite, the oligarchs, are concerned about the image of their country, what kind of impression could President Obama make if he weighed in, or if some high official here like the Secretary of State weighed in on and laid down a marker here in terms of justice and the historical and, you know, truth and reconciliation, but more importantly, justice?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the U.S. has potentially a lot of influence at the moment. It has a lot of influence, or it always has more influence in Central America, actually, than it does in other parts of the world. And the contrast is, I think, quite significant in contrast to the Middle East, which are where the U.S. has also done more than its share of meddling over the years. So, for starters, the United States has influence in the region. It's limited to some degree, but it does have it is able to put pressure. And I think that it can put pressure on the government to a certain extent, because not so much because of the trial or anything to do with the trial necessarily or only, but because Guatemala has a strong interest in other topics that are being discussed, other policy issues that are on the agenda, whether it's drug policy and even more so at the moment, immigration reform. So Guatemala has an interest in getting special consideration as these policies are discussed, policy reform is discussed in Washington. So that's one area where I think the U.S. has quite a bit of leverage. I also think that the United States has leverage with the economic elites. I think that the United States has the pressure of a lot of these people have houses in the United States. I've met many of them who, you know, have houses in Miami. And their kind of sense or concern, even that if people can be found to have tampered and to have sort of put political pressure on, to have bribed judges, et cetera, even threatening to withdraw their visas from the United States would be a possible option.
Well, Anita Isaacs, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me again.
Again, I've been speaking with Anita Isaacs. She's a professor of social sciences and political science at Haverford College. She's the author of Politics of Military Rule and Transition in Ecuador, At War with the Past, and the forthcoming book, The Politics of Transitional Justice in Postwar Guatemala. Her latest article in the New York Times is We Enabled Genocide, But the Elite Committed It. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about Senate hearings today, revealing how little tax Apple pays on their billions in profits.